Welcome to Crime and Caffeine. I'm your host, Erica.
And I'm your host, Allison. Thank you so much for tuning in to another episode.
I thought you were going to pause. I always say I'm going to switch it up and then I don't.
Maybe next time.
I need to practice.
Okay, well, we're already 25 episodes and I think you haven't had enough practice. Anyway, while Erica contemplates what she wants to do differently about her intro, we be sipping on the same coffee that we did in part one. I'm not going to lie to you guys. It's not like we're going to just go out there and overload ourselves with extra coffees because we like this one.
Yes,
La Colombe.
You guys have been so nice and so supportive with buying us coffees. We really appreciate it. We wanted to give a shout out to Megan, who recently bought us a coffee. Your message was so sweet. We really appreciate you and your support. Thank you so much for listening. And we're so happy that you like the show. And yeah,
yes.
So thank you guys so much. If you want to buy us a coffee.
You forgot. We also want to give a shout out to my girl Leah and her mom, who I call Shoddy.
Shoddy.
They bought us coffee too. I know. It was a thing I did when I was really young in cheerleading, but I've known Leah for Lord knows how long. But thank you guys so much for buying us coffee. That was so nice of you. And when Erica told me, I almost lay cried. So love you guys and thank you again.
Yes, thank you. If you want to buy us a coffee, click the link tree in our bio. It has the links to all streaming platforms, plus our website, plus the link to buy us a coffee. If you go onto our website, it's also the first thing that pops up. Shameless promo, but like, you girls, you guys know we're broke, so we want to keep this going.
We drink way too much coffee as it is. We don't want to do repeaters. There's so many coffees out there that need us to try them. This isn't about us. This is about them.
And I will say it's Crime on Caffeine. So like we're open to other forms of caffeine. I will not drink an energy drink. Those are nasty. So no. Anything else?
I will say tea. Yes. Energy drinks really mess me up though. Like I have tried so many times. But I think I have a little bit too much natural energy and it just, it sends me into a whole different dimension.
Oh, we know.
But guys, we know that you just listened to part one and that's why you're here. You're here for part two of the BTK.
And don't you love not having to wait until the following week to listen to the second part?
Yeah, this is something we're just like testing out. So if you guys actually do hate this, please let us know. Or if you prefer it, then let us know too.
Yeah, we wanted it to still be October when we release the episode. So we were like, okay, let's see what we can do. So yeah,
that's why we're here.
Yeah. So in part one, we learned all about Dennis Rader's seemingly normal upbringing, besides the very messed up fantasies that he was having, and the double life that he lived from the 70s up until the 90s. So during these decades, he murdered 10 people, and he taunted the police and the media with letters and poems in hopes that he would get a lot of media attention. He would break into homes after cutting phone lines and stalking them, or what he called trolling, for months. He would troll older women with no husbands or live-in partners and strangle them after tying them up. He had a total of 4 cooling off periods, the most recent starting after the 1991 murder of Dolores Davis. It wasn't until 2004 that the public would hear from BTK again. So, in 2003, there was a lot of talk in the public eye bringing up the BTK and the murders, the case, everything. A lawyer named Robert Beatty was actually writing a book about the investigation, and the Wichita Eagle put out an article in the paper about him because it was the 30th anniversary of the Otero murders. So all of this sudden talk of BTK's rampage angered Lil Den Den.
Lil Den Den.
So in March, the exact date 27 years after he killed his second victim, Shirley Vian. Remember, she was the mother with the 3 kids. He wrote that really messed up poem about her. So he sent the Wichita Eagle photographs of Vicky Weggerly, her murder, and her driver's license. Remember, she was the woman whose husband drove past Dennis as he was driving away from the scene. So the husband was the prime suspect until this time. Now, this is when they're finally able to connect the case because Dennis sent them the photographs. So this is when he is finally let off the hook as the prime suspect. This poor man, 18 years.
That is so sad.
So sad. He also sent KAKE-TV another letter in May of 2004, and it had a word puzzle with clues about his crimes. It was like a word search, and so some of the words that were found in the puzzle that had to do with the case were officer, lost pet, victim, PJ. So PJ is the name of a doll that he sent to an instructor at a college that he attended, and this was the same professor that taught the poem "Oh Death." So just connecting some things. The word fantasies was in there. Telephone company, handyman, prowl, go for it, serviceman, address, realtor, insurance, wrong address, model, for sale, and fake ID. There's a lot more, but we can put it all on there for you guys to look at. I'm just like trying to picture him like making a word search and like how long it probably took this dude. He was dormant for 15 years because he spent the whole time trying to make a word search.
With his terrible grammar, he was like really just sitting there thinking about it.
Yeah, so KAKE-TV, they could not make any sense of this puzzle. They were just like, what the hell? So in July, another letter was found in an engineering book at the Wichita Library. So this was like that first letter that he ever put. So the contents of this letter were never revealed to the public, but it was apparently he was writing a book called The BTK Story, and it was 13 chapters long, and he included the title names of some of the chapters, and he included his poems about Nancy Fox and Anna Williams, the girl who moved away because she was so freaked out. So authorities analyzed the poem, "Oh Nancy," and they attempted to track down like that teacher that I was talking about who taught the poem it was based off of. And in August, they asked the public for help finding her. In November, the police released info to the public about the letters that they'd been receiving over the years. They compiled together everything that they were able to, like all of the little hints and info about who he could possibly be. They put everything together that they could pick out, and they released it all to the public. So this is what they thought: that he was born in 1939, which would make him 64, 65 years old. And keep in mind the info in this, some of it could be true, some of it's not. That obviously is not true. He was born in 1945. Fascination for trains. I have no freaking idea if this is true. His dad died in World War II and was raised by his mother and grandparents. That's not true. His mother worked near the railroad. Not sure if that's true. Attended church and Sunday school as a child. That is true. Had a cousin named Susan who moved to Missouri. No clue. Family moved many times. Always seemed to reside near a railroad. I don't know what this pattern is with railroads. His grandpa played a fiddle and died of lung disease when he was 11 years old. His mother was dating a detective for the railroad. He built and operated a ham radio in the early 1950s. Does anyone know what a ham radio is?
No.
Neither do I, but if we have some older listeners, maybe they do. He likes photography and can print and develop his own photos. We know this is true. He likes fishing, camping, and hunting. He had a Hispanic girlfriend named Petra, and her sister was named Tina. He attended a tech military school, then joined the military. He was discharged in 1966. I want to say true, not exactly remembering the year on that. He moved back in with his mother, who was renting out part of her house. He solicited prostitutes. I don't think that's true. His first employment was an electromechanic, then worked on office equipment. He traveled much and for lengthy times with his work. Not true. So yeah, he was like on America's Most Wanted. They went to Wichita and they filmed a whole segment.
Wow, it's like everything he's ever wanted.
Right? But it's like it's never enough. So in December, a package was found in a park containing like a ton of evidence. There was Nancy Fox's driver's license, another chapter list for his book with titles of some chapters. The chapters that he included when he hid them last time were blank on this one. And then there were like new ones that he could see. So it was totally different titles than the last letter that he hid. Also in December, a suspect was arrested that they thought might have been BTK, but he was cleared after DNA was tested. So more packages were found in January of 2005, and this is where police were able to begin connecting BTK to the murders of Maureen Hedge, which, reminder, the widow who lived on the same street as him for a while. It was the first Cub Scout trip murder. He took her body to the church. And then they were able to connect it to Dolores Davis, who was the second Cub Scout murder and the last known victim in 1991. So these were the two people that he put in their trunks, drove off with, and discarded their bodies somewhere. Obviously, remember, police didn't think it was him because it's not his normal MO. At this point, they were able to connect it just because of like what he was sending them and taunting them with. So on January 8th, he left a package in the back of a man's pickup truck in a Home Depot parking lot. And it was several days before the guy even realized that BTK was written on the box. But because of that drop, the police were able to review the security tape of the parking lot. And they were like, oh my God, like we're going to see who he is. But unfortunately, the camera was too far away and too blurry. But they were able to see that he was driving a black Jeep Cherokee.
So oh, they got something out of it.
Right. Finally. So inside the box was info about future targets that he was looking at and more misleading information about him. He made comments about living in a 3-story apartment building and said he had the elevator rigged with explosives if the police were to like try and go to the apartment and arrest him, which none of this was true. He didn't even live in an apartment during this time. So like, on the other side of things, he was also made president of the church.
Also not so great.
So on January 25th, a letter was sent to KKTV from an Esquilet with the return address being the Otero address. And it gave info into where they would be able to find, quote, communication number 8, as he called it. So it led them to a rural road where they found a cereal box with BTK on it. I don't know. I don't think this like worked as well as he thought it would.
No.
On February 3rd, really weird letters came to KATV. I'm going to read these to you.
Oh God, not again.
So there wasn't a package. It was just like a personal message. He said, thank you for your quick response on number 7 and 8. Thank to the news team for their efforts. Sorry about Susan and Jeff's colds, because 2 of the people there had been sick. That'd be so creepy to be one of those people. I don't know. Under the heading of it, it said, P.S. may want to use, and then it was a code. It said, as code number and letters from me to you for my verification code to you. And then he gave them a message to give the police, but they couldn't share that. But he mentioned the 3 children. He said, they were very lucky. A phone call saved them. I was going to tape the boys and put Platic's bag over their, T-H-E-R-E, head like I did Joseph and Shirley. And then hang the girl. God, oh, instead of an O, it's a 0. God, oh, God. What a beautiful sexual relief this would been.
Ugh.
And so the creepiest part about this, not creepiest, but just one of those little like significant asshole things he does, is these packages that were coming in this year in 2005 were on the anniversaries of the murders that he'd committed. And I feel like he was just doing it because of how the Wichita Eagle did the story on the 30th anniversary of the Oteros. That's kind of what prompted him to come back out of his little cooling off period. I'm wondering if he did that on purpose because that's what they did. So, like I said, those really weird letters. On February 16th, 2005, a package arrived at KSAS-TV, and inside was a floppy disk, a letter, a photocopy of the cover of the book Rules of Prey, and a necklace. Side note, Rules of Prey is a book written by John Sanford about a serial killer who, like, played games with the police, pretty similar to how BTK plays games. And, you know, he mentioned, like, other serial killers that he's trying to live up to or admired or whatever in previous letters. So I'm sure he was kind of thinking the same thing about this character in this book. So the return address on the envelope was PJ Fox. PJ could be in reference to, remember that doll he sent to that teacher? He also used PJ to abbreviate projects. If anybody knows for sure, I don't know if he ever came out and like said specifically what he was referring to, but Fox was obviously alluding to Nancy Fox, because Nancy Fox was also missing a necklace, and the necklace was in this envelope. So that code number that he had given to KAKE to confirm that it was him was the same code number that was in this letter, 24. So they're like, okay, this is actually him. Now, I want to remind everyone that even though he's done some smart things when it comes to these crimes, he's very fucking stupid. So police were able to find...
Not very bright.
Police were able to find metadata on the disc that Dennis didn't know of. And it contained documents from the church with his name all over them. So at this point, they began surveillance, and the BAU and the news stations released all info they had from BTK. Obviously, they didn't say who they thought it was, but they released everything. They released the letters, the chapter titles from the book, like everything. And they were able to obtain a warrant to gather DNA evidence from a pap smear that Rader's daughter got when she was a student at KSU. So they took the DNA from Vicky Weggerly's fingernails to compare, and they got a familial match. So this, yes, combined with all the other evidence, was enough for an arrest. So
that is some brilliance.
Brilliance. On February 25th, 2005, Dennis Rader left his office to head home for lunch. On his drive over, sorry, puberty. On his drive over, he was stopped by an officer who asked if he knew why he was being pulled over. And his response was, "Oh, I have suspicions. Why?"
Oh, dear. Okay.
So he was taken into custody immediately, and the FBI, the KBI, and ATF went and searched his home, his car. They searched the church, everything. And from his home, they took a computer, like computer equipment, black pantyhose, and like some container. I don't know what this container was. They didn't say whether or not they took anything from the church. But his interrogation consisted of literally a 30-hour-long confession. It was like, wow. They said that it felt as if he was just bragging about his endeavors. And the summary of evidence from this is 92 pages long, so I'm not going to read it to you guys if you are so interested, so inclined to do so. You can Google it. So, on February 28, 2005, he was charged with 10 counts of first-degree murder, and he also explained his reasons for resurfacing. He blamed the stories that were coming out about him and said he wanted to be able to tell his story his way, and he also said that his kids were grown up now, so he was bored.
Great.
Join a club. Find a hobby.
Do something else.
So on March 1st, his bail was set at $10 million, and he was issued a public defender. On April 19th, he ended up waiving his right to a preliminary hearing. And then on May 3rd, he was silent, so the judge just entered a not guilty plea on his behalf. They were made aware that he was being charged under Kansas's Hard 40 law, which stated that any crime that was considered cruel and heinous would earn a mandatory minimum sentence of 40 years. Here's the catch. This law wasn't created until 1991, so the 9 murders prior to this time only held a minimum of 15 years each.
Great.
Yeah. So on June 27th, he actually ended up pleading guilty to all 10 counts, and he provided the court with explicit details. So on August 18th, he was sentenced to 10 consecutive life terms for a minimum of 175 years without parole. The death penalty wasn't instilled until 1994, and all of his murders were committed before then, so they couldn't give him that. Of today, he is in solitary confinement.
As he should be.
All right, so let's get into a little psychology. I know throughout the case, we talked a lot about his MO and some things here and there, so I won't be too redundant, but I do want to talk about something, some reasoning behind a few things, and kind of just like his typology.
Let's hear it, girly.
I do want to point something out. So when he was arrested and everything, and he was on trial, his defense team hired a psychologist to interview him, do his psychological evaluation. I searched far and wide for this evaluation. Wikipedia says what he determined. His name is Robert Mendoza. He said that he diagnosed him with narcissistic, antisocial, and obsessive compulsive personality disorders. He pointed out that he has a grandiose sense of self and believes that he's special, and because of that, he's entitled to special treatment. He has a pathological need for attention and admiration, and at the same time, he kind of forces himself to try and keep everything in order and have control. He has zero empathy. But I could not find a single document. All of the articles and everything just said what it says on Wikipedia. Like, there was no document of the actual evaluation. I know there was an interview that was aired on Dateline, but I think the issue here is that Robert Mendoza actually ended up getting sued because they found out that he wanted to benefit financially from this interview, and he ended up settling for like $30,000. So I don't know if that has anything to do with why I can't find anything, but that was his response. Obviously, BTK is someone who has been looked at by so many people, so we'll get some other opinions, but that seems to be pretty much the opinion across the board. Those are the main things to consider regarding like his mental health. But they did get a lot of profiles given by FBI profilers within like the time of his murders and the investigation and everything. One FBI profiler in particular gave two profiles in the late 70s and in the 80s. He's spoken about BTK in so many interviews and presentations and things. And something that was really interesting to me that Hazelwood pointed out was that most sexual sadists only exhibit one type of sexual deviation, and this is their MO. This is what they stick with. That's just like their signature throughout their murders. He says that Dennis Rader exhibited 7 different sexual deviations. So he never like came out and said what they specifically were. So I tried to do some research and narrow it down. This is kind of what I thought. Don't know if this is 100% correct. I just try to find 7 that kind of fit his profile. So fetishism, sexual masochism and sexual sadism, voyeurism, transvestic fetishism, asphyxiophilia. Sometimes some sources put bondage as like a separate paraphilia, but other people include it in like fetishism and sexual masochism. So, I mean, I guess it kind of depends what source you're reading. I put pedophilia question mark because the only time that this was exhibited was with the Otero murders and Josephine. He didn't sexually assault her in any way, but he did relieve himself.
Oh, God.
Which I don't think it's as much. I don't think it's as much the age aspect as much as it is the her being deceased aspect.
Yeah, I think so it's more of a dead body situation than a child situation.
Which, don't know which is worse. Both disgusting and terrible.
Honestly, I can't. Either one. I'm grossed out.
So he would be classified as an organized serial killer. I know we've discussed this. His crimes were well planned in advance. He targeted strangers. One big characteristic among organized killers is that they kind of use these tactics to make the victims feel bad for them, like put themselves in a bad situation to like trick them almost. So it was like him using the ploy of being on the run and needing money and food to try and get them to be more vulnerable, I guess, and trust him a little bit more and think he's not going to hurt them. So that's something that they often do. The crime scenes themselves definitely, for the most part, reflect control, you know, when he goes and cleans everything up. Obviously, the victims being tied up shows that as well. Him just wanting to be dominant over his victims is another aspect of being an organized killer, using restraints, the weapon not being at the crime scene as well, and then also just the concept of him bringing his own tools. Interestingly enough, he is just one of those serial killers who is so different than any other serial killer. I just think that he could be studied so much because he just did not stick with these things that everybody else does. So something that is a characteristic of an organized killer is transporting the bodies to another area. And he only did this with two of his victims at a point when it seemed like he was kind of devolving. So It was when like things didn't go according to plan that he became disorganized. With Catherine Bright, when he stabbed her, disorganization right there because he's becoming violent and changing up the way that he kills. But it's so interesting to me that transporting the bodies is a characteristic of an organized killer when he started off 8 out of 10 of his victims, he just left at the crime scene. So that's interesting to me. So high birth order is also often associated, and he is the oldest out of 5 boys total. Mobility, he always had a car. He would often use the victim's car as well. Following the crime in the media is a huge aspect of being an organized serial killer as well. So he definitely did that. Always having a job or like changing jobs. So he was always able to have a steady source of income, always doing something with labor. Living with a long-term partner as well. Often with disorganized serial killers, they live alone. They can't form long-term relationships or anything like that. With an organized killer, the ability to live that double life is a huge characteristic. So we do have some deviations from this organized classification. Like I said, Catherine Bright, just the method of killing her and just the violence that came from like him being stressed out about what happened with Kevin and just not going according to plan. His long cooling off period is very, very different. He's the only organized killer to have this long of a cooling off period, just because at the end of the day, serial killers cannot stop killing, especially if it involves sexual gratification. The only way that they stop is if they're dead or they're incarcerated or there is something that is straight up preventing them from being able to do whatever. But he was just like living his normal life. So I don't know if it has anything to do with the dichotomy of at this time he was only being this person. I'm not saying he has DID or anything like that, but he definitely was living like 2 lives at once. So
yeah,
that's very interesting and very different. It's one of those things that makes him different than any other serial killer.
So weird.
There's the aspect of de-escalation as well. So normally with serial killers, like I said, mainly organized serial killers, their murders will start out kind of messy, just because like if it's their first time doing it or whatever, and not as perfect. And then eventually, as time goes on, each one gets easier for them and it's more controlled each time. So it's less messy with the more that they commit, which makes sense, right?
Yeah.
This was the exact opposite for him. Each murder was messier and more botched than the last. So that's just him de-escalating. And it's super interesting just because of how organized he was. I also want to talk about changes in MO because organized killers normally don't have changes in MO. And if they do, they're very slight and just to a certain degree. While the killer's signature often remains the same, mostly because the killer doesn't know why they're doing it. They just do it and they can't help it. For example, Ted Bundy was killing women who looked like his ex. He was just killing women. He wasn't thinking in his head like, oh, I'm going to kill her because she looks like my ex. It was just something that he was doing. That was his signature.
Right.
So for Dennis, the thing that he said was that factor X that he used to blame his killing. So what exactly is factor X? Dr. Catherine Ramsland studied him in prison for like 5 years, and she wrote an entire book on him. And he looked to her to try and explain it to him, because he was like, I don't know why I do this. I know it's because of factor X, but I don't know what's controlling it. He was like, I don't know if it's a demon or what. Mm-hmm. And she just said it was a way for him to deflect his guilt and kind of mitigate his actions, neutralize them, by basically saying he's a natural born killer, so it's not his fault, it's what he was born to do. And he compared it to like a snake's venom killing an animal or another person. It's not the snake's fault, that's what they were born to do. So like that's what he compares it to, which is just whack.
No, this is not right.
But he had a lot of changes in MO that made it really hard to pinpoint what exactly his signature was. For example, killing victims in their homes and leaving them there versus transporting them somewhere else. While this could be seen as escalation, how he like changed from doing it one way to the other, he murdered Vicky Wiggerly in between those two women and did it in his normal style. So it really wasn't an aspect of him escalating and getting messier and more out of control. It was literally like he was switching from organized to disorganized. So many dichotomous aspects to this, I feel like. It's just insane to me. It's literally like he's two different people, like an organized person and a disorganized person. So overall, he would be considered power control killer, a lust killer, sexual sadist, all of those, just due to the power and dominance he wants to have over his victims. He is stalking strangers. They're very planned and organized. So that's pretty easy to tell. Allison, this is the one that you've been waiting for.
Thank you.
I did want to discuss revelations that were found after his arrest and just kind of what they mean. Specifically, the photos of him found in victims' clothing. Ooh. And he himself is tied up, which he was aroused by, like, him being tied up himself.
She's crazy.
But it's believed that killers will dress in their victims' clothing or like use or wear their personal items in an attempt to kind of recreate the crime scene and like relive that moment and achieve sexual gratification once again. So his own photos of himself were additional souvenirs in addition to the photos he took of his victims or the jewelry that he stole and the clothes, obviously, things like that. So just so weird to me.
I hate it too.
And then the last thing that I really wanted to talk about was something that amazes me the most about him, which is another thing that makes him so different from other serial killers. There's only like two other people I can really think of off the top of my head that had this same situation, but the nature versus nurture concept, because this man, from what we have learned, from what we have heard, he had a totally normal childhood. What the hell could have caused this then?
I know. It just honestly, it had to have just been a screw loose. It couldn't have been impacted by his life because there wasn't any triggers from his life. He had to have been born just not there.
100%. So that screw loose that you were referring to could possibly be the thalamus. So one explanation could be that his thalamus might be defected, which on one hand causes him to not feel any emotion, but defected thalamus is also linked to OCD. And when the orbital frontal cortex sends worry signals to the thalamus, the brain will kind of like prevent your thalamus from becoming overactive. But if it's defected, it's going to ignore those signals altogether. So that's going to cause those actions that are associated with OCD. His OCD kind of really comes out in the final murders that he does. He becomes so obsessed with all of his victims, stalking them to like the fullest extent. Those women that he stalked that he didn't even end up killing, and then he stayed contacting them, like Anna Williams. He worked for so long on these women, stalking them, like way longer than originally, and just tried to show like extreme control and perfectionism, trying to make the murders exactly how he wanted. Totally perfect. Obviously, this doesn't happen because he's stupid, but that would just be something that would come from the thalamus being defected. Obviously, I don't have a brain scan sitting in front of me that I can confirm that that's true, but that's just one theory.
You didn't find his brain scans for us?
No, I meant to actually go take them myself, but yeah, I didn't have time this week.
If so, that man's thalamus loose.
His thalamus loose. But there are some people who try to maybe explain certain things in his childhood that could contribute to other parts of his personality. So as far as narcissism goes, obviously his parents weren't cruel or abusive towards him. So maybe they kind of were too nice to him and like let him get away with too much and kind of like hyped him up a little too bit. And that contributed to the narcissism. Obviously, we don't know that for sure, but that is a theory. Other theories were talking about how involved they were with church and how maybe that could have suffocated him. Those thoughts in his head, he kind of had to force himself to repress, especially with the aspect of going to church. Mm-hmm. Those are clearly sins. So, I mean, when you do that, obviously, shit's going to come out. Shit's going to blow up. I don't know.
They say shit's going to hit the fan.
Hit the fan. Thank you. That's what I was looking for.
Shit's going to blow up.
But yeah, he is chilling in prison right now. He was recently, in the last couple of years, I think, given like TV and book privileges for good behavior and stuff like that. He had to register as a sex offender. He didn't penetrate any of his victims, which is, I think, something that like you don't really think about.
He was diddling himself to them. So yeah. That's gross enough.
Mm-hmm. 100%.
That's too much for me.
So yeah, that is good old Den-Den, Dennis Lynn Rader, the BTK. I hate him.
Wow, what a time. That was
a wild ride.
Yeah, that was a lot, honestly, and I just hate him.
I will be taking a break from the serial killer murder type of episodes for a while.
What? You gonna leave it to me?
So if you have any unsolved missing people cases that you want to recommend, please let me know.
Missing people's. Well, yeah, thanks for all that. That was good stuff.
Yeah. Happy Halloween, guys.
Happy Halloween.
Comment what you're being for Halloween on the post.
Oh my God, yeah. Comment what you're being for Halloween and then obviously, all the good stuff. Make sure to follow us on Instagram, subscribe on Apple Podcasts, subscribe or follow on Spotify, DM us, email us. We need more cases. We need more coffees. We need you.
We need more listeners.
We do need more listeners. So share this with all of your friends, all your family, your neighbors' neighbors, the people across the street from your neighbors' neighbors, and their dogs.
Maybe don't share this episode with your family, but like any others.
No, share it with them. Let them know.
All right. Well, thank you guys so much. Have a happy and safe Halloween, and we will talk to you in November.